Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon. And she mentioned there's a quorum present. Senator Sharon.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Cohen. I'm here to present Senate File 5, but it would be helpful if I could have someone offer the amendment, the A11 amendment.
Sure. I'll offer it.
Okay. We have the A11 amendment, which is it being distributed? Is that, okay. Senator Stumpf moves adoption of the amendment. At the request of the author, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. The amendment, simply for your information, articulated clearly where transfers are being directed once made to cover out of the healthcare access fund. Just a further clarification. Good morning. I'd like to just take a few moments of your time to explain what Senate File 5 does. This is a bill that expands medical assistance coverage for certain groups. It expands MA coverage, and in your materials, I'm hoping that there was a sheet that looks like this. It was used in earlier committee hearings, and the MA income limits and the proposed changes in income limits, the federal poverty guidelines for what it means in terms of meeting federal poverty guidelines is articulated there simply for your clarification. But the expands MA coverage for single adults up to 133% of the federal poverty guideline. The expansion includes single adults, parents, and relative caretakers up to the age of 65 and 19 and 20-year-olds. This expansion is fully funded by the federal government for the first 3 years, beginning in 2014, and is 95% funded by the federal government for the next 3 years, beginning in 2017, excuse me, and phases down by 2022, 90% federal coverage. For your information, we are currently covering these populations either in medical assistance or Minnesota Care, and receiving only a 50% match. 87,000 more people would be covered on MA as a result of this expansion, and 53,000 of those people are currently on Minnesota Care. It makes federally required changes to comply with the Affordable Care Act. It makes it federally required changes to the medical assistance by implementing the use of a modified adjusted gross income, or MAGI, and a 5% standard income disregard. This is a requirement under the Affordable Care Act. It specifies that asset limits only apply to parents and relative caretakers who qualify for MA with a spend down. The only current asset limit that applies to this group is $20,000 for parents, however. So none of the other groups currently have asset limits. All groups would not have any asset limits by 2014 under the Affordable Care Act. It transfers funds from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund to pay for health care services provided under MA for former Minnesota Care enrollees. We think it's important to support this bill because the expansion is authorized by the Affordable Care Act, and we can take advantage of the opportunity to expand coverage to these individuals. These individuals would get a better coverage on this program than on Minnesota Care, because Minnesota Care requires participants pay premiums and have a $10,000 hospital cap on asset tests. MA doesn't. Allowing more people to be eligible for improved coverage will help reduce health disparities as well. Minnesota Care already covers 53,000 of these 87,000 that would be covered under this expansion, and we pay 50% of the costs of Minnesota Care. This expansion would cover this population at 100%. And that's where the cost savings lies for the state budget. The federal government covers the entire cost of the expansion for the first 3 years and much of the cost for the following years. This is better than the 50% match we are currently receiving. Lack of coverage increases uncompensated care costs, so this expansion also helps our medical facilities, who testified in front of earlier committees. Then they would have less of a need to pass on those costs to paying consumers and taxpayers. The expansion is projected to save $123 million in the next biennium, $227 million in the following biennium. And you have a fiscal note with you among your materials. And if that is an adequate explanation, I would lay the bill in front of the committee for discussion.
Senator Sharon, let me ask. It's my understanding the fiscal note indicates I think a total of about $130 million for the fiscal for the biennium. I think these monies have been taken into the budget forecast. Is that correct?
The implications of this legislation will not be taken into the forecast unless there's an action taken by this committee.
Okay, but I thought, or Mr. Nauman, maybe I could inquire. I thought, it was my understanding from the administration, I thought these monies were being counted in some way.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I think the way to think about this is that, with new information subsequent to the November forecast, there would be a forecasting adjustment in terms of how these populations would be counted if the bill were not passed. So I'll let Mr. Albrecht put the numbers on this scenario, but we had an assumption about 100% federal reimbursement up to the 75% level in the November forecast. With new information, we would make the Department of Management and Budget and Human Services would make a different forecast assumption for that population as a 0% federal reimbursement in the February forecast. Essentially, new information leads us in a different direction, and this would flag, depending on how you count the numbers, $1.2, $1.3 billion of additional cost in the February forecast if the bill were not passed.
So, Mr. Albrecht, do you want to help us out with the exact numbers?
Mr. Chair, I spoke with Mr. Nauman earlier this morning, and those are the numbers that I would add.
Okay. So, Sarah Laurie?
Mr. Chair, maybe I can help a little bit. So the forecast would not be crafted around these changes unless we actually put these changes into law. And the change that was that came down was that if we've already expanded to 75% of federal poverty level. We did that as the early expansion. It was one of the first things done under this administration. And one of the rulings that came out was that the feds were not going to allow partial expansions. So they, you know, in the Affordable Care Act, there was a requirement that states expand up to 138% of federal poverty level. And the Supreme Court said that that the feds can't require that in exchange for continuation of existing longstanding Medicaid arrangements with the state and the federal government. And so partial expansions, which is what the 75% would be looked at, would not be covered at all by federal funds. And so our forecast had assumed that the 75 would be covered at 100%, but then we found out that actually that would be considered a partial expansion, and partial expansions would be counted at zero. And so were we to recraft the forecast in February, according to current law, that 100% assumption that was in the November forecast would be a 0% coverage, and it would look really awkward, because I think it's well understood that this is really financially beneficial to the state. And so we will have a much more accurate reflection in the February forecast if we go ahead and make these changes so that to current law will better reflect what the actual experience in Minnesota is going to be.
And if I'm not mistaken, the Supreme Court decision of June, with kind of a unique twist, would allow us to not comply.
Right.
But in the process, we would lose how much then by way of federal funding over the – is it over the 4 years or the 3.5 years?
Well, the current law, we expanded for childless adults up to 75% of federal poverty level. We're doing that today at 50%, but the assumption was that that was going to be at 100% beginning January 1, 2014. And so current law carries Medicaid eligibility up to 75% of federal poverty level. I don't know the actual number behind it. Mr. Albrecht could probably fill that in. But we assumed 100% for that population, and that was fine, and we hadn't expanded to the 138. But it's actually zero that we would collect on that up to 75% if we weren't to make these changes. And that's the issue with the forecast. And so if we want it to be accurate, we should get these changes into law so that when they craft the forecast to current law, this is incorporated, and it will give us a much better view of and more accurate view of what we can expect.
So Mr. Albrecht, what's the accounting then in terms of dollars into the forecast?
Mr. Chair, it's about $1.2 billion, and that's for 14 and 15.
And then for 15, 16?
I'm
or does
sorry,
it only go for 16, 17, I meant.
Yeah, I don't have those numbers with me.
But we assume it's something similar or greater.
It would continue, I believe, yes.
Okay. All right. Further questions, discussion on the part of the committee? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, following Senator Lurie's discussion of going only partial, and he said 138%, and that's the number I've heard. I heard Senator Sharon say 133% in her presentation to the committee. Doesn't that only still get us partial way there and not all the way if we're at 130%?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I failed to also talk about the fact that there is a 5% income set aside, which brings us to 138% of poverty, which is the number that Senator Lurie was talking about.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up.
Yep, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, Senator Lurie talked about the June Supreme Court decision.
Yes.
And what effect did that – can you explain to us in the committee of what options it gave us as a state? Because as I recall the opinion, and it's been a while since I read the results of that, but there was an option for the state that the federal government couldn't coerce states into doing things and taking on more future burden of expense. But could you being the author and carrying this, you probably have a better grasp of that. Can you
thank you
explain to us what the options are?
I think that you've articulated it fairly well, that the original law required states to participate would have or lose funding at the original funding that we had, 50% funding. And the court said that you could not coerce. So it changed it to an option, that states have the option to expand. And we implemented an expansion up to 75%. And now are asking our legislature to determine whether we want to continue that expansion fully up to 138% of poverty. So that is accurate, that what changed was the fact that the states must take an action to say that they do want to participate in this program and accept the federal dollars and also the state's obligations in relationship to it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wisdom.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. If you could, so 75%, though, after the Supreme Court decision is not an option for us to just partially expand. Do I understand it right? We would have to either go to the 138 or revert back to where we were. And if you can verify that or answer that part, but then refresh for me and the committee, if instead we reverted back, where would we be? What was the status before we had current law at 75%?
Sarah Sherman.
We can revert back. We can stay at 75. We can revert back. We can do a number of things we want to, but we cannot accept. We will not be able to receive the federal dollars. That's the consequence for that. And if there was another part of your question, I'm sorry, I forgot
Chair,
it.
What is it if we revert back? We're at 75%. Was the number 50 before, or did it not exist before? What?
GMC fully state funded.
Yeah. If we do not expand, we revert to what was our general assistance medical care program or something like that we designed, that is fully the responsibility of the state. That's what we can do if we choose to.
Okay. And last question.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, are you in agreement that, because what you said, it sounded like maybe we could just stay at 75% after the Supreme Court decision and now get reimbursed from the federal government. But is that not correct? And
I'm sorry if I was unclear. We can do anything less than 138% of poverty, but it changes what our state's obligation would be. And if we stayed at 75% specifically, we would be back in the same situation we were under general assistance medical care, in which the states were fully responsible for covering that out of the general fund.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lori, the exchange between you and Senator Westrum explained or answered my first question, and that was whether or not this was mandatory or simply authorized. And I think I understand the reason why is because, according to Senator Lori, we are going to be reimbursed a significant amount of money from the federal government if we do this. And it sounded to me like that is true through the fiscal year 2017. What happens, Senator, after 2017? Does the state of Minnesota pick up the entire tab or a portion of the tab or none of the tab for the Medicaid expansion?
Sarah Sharon.
Thank you very much. It's 100% for 3 years, then 95%. By the federal government for the next 3 years, and then beginning in 2017, it is 95%, and phases down after that to 90% by 2020.
So, Senator Sharon, is the 90% then assumed to be an ongoing figure subsequent to 2020?
It is assumed that will be the continuing responsibility of the federal government in partnership with the states.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, you talked about the savings per year, 120 to 130 million. I'm just generalizing those numbers, but the bottom line is we are now going to be funded by the federal government. I mean, if we choose to do this, by the federal government. So that is showing the savings to the state of Minnesota, correct? Isn't that correct?
Correct. The savings that we're talking about is that the state's obligation is reduced by that amount.
Thank you. And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, if I could. This really doesn't have a whole lot to do with this committee, but are there some chance down the line, and maybe Senator Cohen can help me with this as well, that we get this federal funding that is not mandated. We can make a decision not to do that. I get that. But along with dealing with the federal government, a lot of times comes red herring, if you will, or some kind of attachments to it that if you don't do it, you get penalized or you get your funding dropped. Special ed's a prime example. Special ed's a prime example of underfunding a mandate that we were going to get money from the Fed. So I guess my question is probably a little bigger. What would be, should the federal government get into more serious trouble than they are right now and lock up, if you will, and I don't know what the terms that are being thrown around where funding will cease or funding will have to be reduced. Is there any chance that this would be part of that funding reduction? Maybe it's a question I'm just kind of strapping with, if anybody knows that answer.
Senator Cohen.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, why do you think I would know the answer to that?
I don't know. I just put an awful lot of weight into you. Into your politics, I guess. Maybe somebody else can answer me that.
Senator Cohen.
I see us going down the same thing, the same path here, where it's a wonderful idea. Well, we're saving lots of money. No, we're not saving lots of money. We're just taking it from a different pocket. And if we do that, that's fine. But if some all of a sudden comes a regulation that we can't quite live with, well, we're going to be like the special ed then. We're not going to do any more funding. You understand the question.
Well, Senator Brooks, there's no question that the same constitutional authority exists at a federal level as exists at a state level, that you can't bind a future Congress to do something 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now. Under your hypothetical, certainly the federal Congress and the president, whoever they might be, 10 years from now, could make a significantly different decision. The history has been over the years that generally has not happened, where there's been a significant intersection between state and federal policy. That's certainly not with Social Security. That has not been the case, say, with the establishment of Medicare in 65. I think in this particular instance, if your reference is to the sequestering debate or sequestration debate in the current Congress, I think this is exempt from it, I believe. Maybe Mr. Nauman, Mr. Albrecht's nodding his head yes. So at least insofar as where we are today, there wouldn't be a problem. As to what happens 30 years from now, of course, it won't be my responsibility then, so possibly yours, but not mine.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair, for that optimism. Thanks for the answer, too. I know it is hard to even guess what's going to come out of Washington, D.C. from now. And I'm not talking about any particular party in particular. It's just, as we know, it just doesn't seem to get settled, and things just keep right on going, and pretty soon we got to deal with the debt ceiling again. And it just seems to me sometimes when you do business with people like that and include all 435 of them and 100 on the other side, it just seems like it's kind of risky. But I understand the idea of us not having to pay the money. We're just taking it from a different pocket. Thank you.
Sarah Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I hear quite often when I visit with different providers in my district and area is that the reimbursement isn't adequate to cover the service that's being delivered. And I'm wondering, and I'm not sure, sometimes I hear Medicaid, sometimes I hear other, public programs. And do we know, is this going to improve the reimbursement rate to providers over what they would normally get or currently get?
Sarah Sherman.
Thank you. No, there's nothing in this bill that speaks to rates that are to providers. When the providers came to testify in support of this legislation, they understood that the benefit that they would be receiving is in not having to pass on uncompensated care costs. That's the critical support for our providers, especially with the removal of the $10,000 cap for hospitals. So that's the benefit. But the issue of rates is a separate issue that we will have to address in our other budgetary considerations based on our capacity to pay that.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, the other part that is often brought up is providers will suggest that if people who come in who are on some sort of a program had to pay some small part, even a modest, just more of even a nominal. I don't know what you'd call it. It wouldn't necessarily be a deductible, but something similar to that, that there would be less chance for those people to kind of come into the emergency room and use expensive delivery.
Senator Sherman.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stumpf. The Affordable Care Act allows states in relationship to its Medicaid program to design incentives for not overutilizing or inappropriately utilizing the system. There isn't anything in this bill that speaks to that, but that issue is one of concern that we hear, that as you expand access, well, it simply opened the floodgates and people will the cost now will be driven by overuse or overutilization. And although this bill does not speak to that, there is language in the Affordable Care Act in relationship to this that allows us to use, if it's a copay, if it's some other kind of a reward system for use of primary care as opposed to the emergency room, all of that kind of discussion can occur and is allowable under the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, to follow up on Senator Ingebretson's question as to whether or not, you know, what happens if the money from the feds doesn't show up, is there anything in your bill that would retain, that where Minnesota would retain the right to back off if the feds didn't send the money, or is there anything in the Affordable Care Act that would prevent the state of Minnesota from backing away if the federal government did not fulfill its obligations?
Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. There is no obligation for the state of Minnesota to remain in this partnership with the federal government. They can withdraw themselves from this agreement at any time and without any statement of cause. They simply have to make a modification in their plan to the federal government, and that's clearly articulated in the rules in relationship to this expansion.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Sharon. You know, I think every time I meet with a county commissioner, I get a list of things that they call are unfunded mandates. In your mind, does this fall into that category for counties in terms of additional costs that they're going to experience that they're not going to get reimbursed for?
Senator Sharon.
I have a Rolodex review process, so I'm sort of going like this. I do know that there is money that's provided to states to help them make the accommodations to the new income eligibility MAGI standard. The technological costs that are associated with that are 90% funded at the federal level. And there is also a process for simplifying the eligibility requirement process, and it allows states to access this information technologically in a very simple way. So I think that as that system gets built, what counties will be experiencing is these efficiencies. Right now, there's a complex set of different applications and different systems, and it's a very intensive kind of process that will be reduced because we move to the MAGI, and because the federal government is engaged in this process of helping us develop the infrastructure and simplification of eligibility process. So overall, I believe as the system is operating, these efficiencies will create cost savings for both state and local level. But that's an assumption I'm making.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, so it would be safe for me to, you know, if I get questioned on this issue from our county health and human services staff, it'd be safe for me to say that there shouldn't be any cost for them based on technology improvements.
Thank you. They already are expending resources to do this, so it's probable that they'll be able with these efficiencies to not exceed that, although there may be in the adjustment process newly eligibles that are coming in that will require some additional time at the county level to determine eligibility.
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I think that's the issue or the thought process a county commissioner goes through. We're expanding this and allowing more people, and I'm not necessarily opposing your bill, but I'm thinking ahead to the questions, you know, that I'm going to receive with that expansion and bringing more people on. And a county commissioner is going to think right away, well, you're increasing our costs at the state capitol. So, is that accurate or not? Are we increasing costs for local governments through this process?
Senator Sharon.
Well, my sense is that the process in which you have the access to the new technology and the simplification of the eligibility process and the use of MAGI in order to calculate will create simplifications, and that will occur at the same time as the implementation. So I think that whenever there is change, there is some investment that everybody is making in that change, and to the degree that there are costs associated with that.
Mr. Chair, I just have one more question. And, you know, I've heard Senator Sharon mention the use of technology a couple different – I'll wait till you're finished there. Mr. Chair, I had a question for you specifically. I've heard Senator Sharon mention the use of technology a couple times, and I see on page 3 of our fiscal note here it talks about administrative costs, and depending on the MMIS system interactions with the potential health insurance exchange, it appears that there would be a significant use of technology or information systems. So my question is, did this fiscal note go to our chief information officer to review?
Mr. Nauman, I don't have the answer to that, Senator Peterson. Mr. Nauman, do you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, chief information officer, do you mean
our technology officer? I mean, our fiscal note policy.
Yes.
Our fiscal note policy clearly states when we have a bill that relates with information technology that that they need to review the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, it was not sent to that particular agency.
Chair, I'd suggest you lay this bill on the table until our information technology people get a chance to review this bill.
Senator Peterson, obviously you can make such a motion. I'm not going to do it unilaterally. But now you're talking about the agency. Is that correct? You're not talking about some of the internal Senate. You're talking about the agency.
Right.
So
we have an agency that deals
with Michelle Parnell or whoever within her agency. It's my understanding that a lot of this is reviewed by that agency. I'm not sure that they actually participate in the promulgation of the fiscal note. I don't know if anybody's here from the agency, but Senator Laurie, do you have something to?
That would be a non-debatable motion. It hasn't been
there's no motion
as a motion yet, but maybe a little bit of context. This bill wouldn't change the technology that would need to be applied to this population. That's in a different bill. This is merely talking about the eligibility levels at which people can get onto Medicaid. Whether we change this or not, everybody under 400% of federal poverty level under the ACA much more broadly is going to be coming through the eligibility system and needing to be have this MAGI new eligibility test applied. So, and I do know that OIT is significantly engaged in looking at the technology costs of that implementation, but it's not really engaged in whether or not we expand Medicaid eligibility. And an additional point that lends a lot of impetus behind this and makes it incredibly important is that because the Affordable Care Act was written with this expansion to 133-138 as a mandate, and that's what the law says, it assumed that these individuals would not be eligible for the advanced premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reductions, and so they are not eligible for that. So if we don't expand Medicaid eligibility to 138, we leave these people with really no options at all other than 100% state support. They will not be eligible. They will come in, will incur the costs for these systems because everybody under 400% will have to come through and be evaluated under the MAGI standard, and we won't have any place to assist them unless the state puts up significant funds to do so. So the system's costs are interacting with other bills that we'll hear in this committee, presuming they continue to keep moving. And they're not really heavily engaged in this bill. And so we will see them. This is really just at what level Medicaid is available to individuals. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Ingebrigtsen was the head of
the just a comment, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Laurie, for that. I don't think anybody's disagreeing with what we probably are going to be doing here moving forward, but what Senator Peterson is very clearly inquiring about is with that kind of a change, whether it's for the state's good or for the state's bad, for that matter. There has to be some technology issues, and if they're not covered in a fiscal note, it would be fair to know what that's going to cost. Maybe it's going to not cost anything. Maybe it's going to save something. If that's noted in here, why, then we're probably off and running.
Senator Bonoff.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a question on a different subject, so are you – I don't know. Okay.
Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair, I heard Senator Sharon mention technology, I think, three different times in the questions I asked. And clearly in our fiscal note policy manual on page 13, I just found it here, it says bills with technology impact. It says in all cases, fiscal notes with a technology-related impact must be reviewed and improved by the agency's chief information officer, the CIO, prior to submission. So has that happened or not?
Mr. Nauman, you've available information.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I think I might be able to illuminate this a little bit more. This is going to be an ongoing challenge for technology-related issues with respect to the new minute structure that was passed, was that last year or the year before?
2 years ago.
So the issue becomes, did we need to have a separate fiscal note review at minute or not? And it's my understanding, based on some conversations that I've just had with agency staff, that the minute staff are actually part of the review at the Department of Human Services for the simple fact that they were housed there. And so that was part of the review. They are eligible for 90% reimbursement by virtue of the fact that they are staff that are working on this particular project. So I understand that this is going to be a bit challenging. And we're going to have to maybe vet through some of these as they come. But in this particular case, it's based on what I've learned from the agency. They were part of the review on this fiscal note.
And to that point, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Bonoff.
I did carry the bill that consolidated all of the IT under one agency that is now called Minute. And that was the idea, to not actually have to move people around to all sit in the same area, but to be co-located so that you'd have the expertise of Minute embedded within each of the divisions. So that actually does make sense, Mr. Nauman. But I still did have a follow-up question.
Yes,
when you're ready.
There's no further discussion on that issue, Senator Bonoff.
Pardon?
If there's no further discussion on that issue,
thank you.
Senator
Bonoff.
Okay. Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so it's your position that the IT impact on this bill has already been reviewed? Is that?
Based on what Mr. Nauman has indicated, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so the question I had, Senator Sharon, was with regard to Minnesota Care. So I see, as I've done review of your bill, that 53,000 approximately people who would be covered were coming directly from Minnesota Care. And while I assume that as we do the exchange bill, we'll hear a more thorough conversation about the what's going to happen with Minnesota Care, I'm wondering, with this transfer of enrollees, does that have a significant effect currently on Minnesota Care? And if you could just apprise the committee of what's happening with that.
Sarah Sharon.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Mr. Albrecht to articulate what the impact this will have on the Minnesota Care Fund, which I think is what the essence of your question is, which is a broader discussion. But in relationship to this bill, what we are creating is savings. But as we talk about the next level of a legislation that Senator Lori will be introducing at some point here at 138% to 200%, these questions become more critical and more relevant. But in relationship to this bill, there's cost savings.
Okay. Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, and members, if you go to page 6 of the fiscal note, near the top there is a section titled Enrollment Summary, and the second line there shows the change in enrollment by year for the Minnesota Care population. The first line shows you the change in enrollment for MA. So those folks who are leaving Minnesota Care, who number 24,000 by the end of 4 years, are all going into the MA program. Is that the question?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Albrecht, I guess I was wondering about the health of Minnesota Care when you take out this number of enrollees, does the fund then experience difficulty because the size of the pool is that much smaller? Is there a particular health aspect to those that are leaving that affects the health of Minnesota Care one way or another?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, no. The impact on the Minnesota Care Fund, the Health Care Access Fund, from this bill is the savings that's on the front page of $129 million. So that would be added to the balance.
Very good. Thank you.
Sarah Laurie, did you have
a... No.
After, yes. Sarah Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, actually, to Senator Bonhoff's point, why is this bill not being included in the omnibus bill? It seems like it has a lot of far-reaching effects, and I'm just wondering why we're not waiting and putting this into the omnibus bill.
Senator Sharon.
May I? I'm unclear as to what the far-reaching effects are. That
well,
that
I mean, the issue, the impacts on MinCare, the, you know, I guess maybe far-reaching. There are a lot of other impacts that it impacts other areas of the budget. And so I'm just kind of wondering why we wouldn't just include it in the omnibus bill instead of pushing this through so quickly and not looking at all of the – there's lots of questions going on, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Sharon.
Well, I think that I think the information that we have is clear enough to allow us to make a decision now. We want to take advantage of and be clear that we're going to proceed with capturing the cost savings. And because of the earlier discussion that related to what the actions of this legislature will have on what we'll have to deal with in the February forecast.
Further questions, Senator?
Mr. Chair, I did have another. That was just to Senator Bonhoff's point. I do have the A-12 amendment that I'd like to offer.
We're having this distributed. Senator Fishbach, looks very creative. Did you
Mr.
write
Chair,
this?
There was some questions from Senator Ingebrigtsen and Senator Newman regarding the loss of federal funds, if federal funds are decreased, and basically what this does. And this is an amendment that Senator Nienau had intended to offer and was unable to get here because of the snow today. But if for some reason our federal funding falls below 90%, then we would revert back to the standards that we are under now. And in addition, the members of the legislature, the ranking members, the chairs, would be informed so that we could address that if we needed to. So this might alleviate some of the concerns about the federal funding issue. And Senator Sharon did indicate that there shouldn't be a problem, that we could get out whenever we needed to. So this is a way that the legislature can be informed regarding the federal funding level if there is a concern.
Senator Fishbach, let me ask a question. I want to hear from Senator Sharon, but you've got the date of December 31st, 2013, in terms of eligibility standards. What happens if in subsequent federal legislation that becomes a date that's irrelevant so that whatever is available on a federal level reflects, say, standards of, you know, December 31st, 2019? But then we're stuck with the 2013 date.
Well, Mr. Chair, my understanding, and I mentioned that earlier, that this was Senator Nienau's amendment, but I wanted to offer it on his behalf. I believe it would be our standards, and if it's not written exactly that way, that was my understanding. But so that what we had our eligibility at prior to the loss of the federal.
Okay. Senator Sharon, comment on the A-12 amendment.
Thank you. This question has been raised at every committee hearing, whether or not we need to have such an amendment or such a contingent sunset. I think it's absolutely unnecessary, and that the law already provides what we need in order to resolve issues if there's changes in what action happens at the federal level.
Senator Wistrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually ties into one of the questions I had prior to the amendment, but it's specifically related to this amendment. Senator Sharon, you refer to the federal law. Have you actually read the federal law, and does it actually say 100% till 2017, 95% for the next 3 years, and the federal government is required to provide 90% thereafter? Or what does that language actually say, if you can share with us as a committee?
If you're asking me if I actually read this in the law, the answer to that is no. But the CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has consistently articulated and clarified what it is that the relationship will be between the states and the Affordable Care Act. And in this language, there's clear articulation of what the federal government's contribution will be to the Medicaid program, and clear language that says that states have the right to withdraw from this program at any time.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, could we have somebody from CMS come and tell us that so it's on the record?
I can ask DHS to come forward if that will give further assurances, but they've assured me that it is clearly articulated in law.
Sure, if there's somebody from the agency who can offer that. Could identify yourself for the record. And,
yes, my name is Susan Hammerston. I'm the Healthcare Reform Implementation Team Manager at DHS. At this date, I have actually stopped carrying my copy of the ACA around with me, so I can't give you the exact citation. I can provide that in follow-up to the committee. But the matching rates, the federal matching rates, are very clearly laid out in the ACA text.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, would you... So are you here representing to us and would affirm that you've read the text and it says 90% thereafter, after the six-year period that... Senator Sharon, could you get us that information? I assume this is going to the floor next. Before we get to the floor, it would be nice to have that information from DHS or CMS. Sure. But my question related to that, and either one of you that know, and maybe to the representative from the department. So would it take federal votes or actions to change the 90%, or will it take a vote to affirm 90% to continue after 2020 at 90%? Do you know which way it would be?
Senator Sharon.
I want to make sure that I understand what information specific, if Senator Westrum wants the specific language from the law. We can clearly provide from CMS language that says, while states have flexibility to start or stop the expansion, the applicable federal match rates for medical assistance provided to newly eligible individuals are tied by law to specific calendar years outlined in the statute. And then it articulates states will receive 100% for the newly eligible adults in 2014-15 and 16, 95 in 2017, and 94% in 2018, 93% in 2019, and 90% in 2020, remaining at that level thereafter.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, what are you reading me? Is that some text you've
yes,
been providing?
Yes, and I can provide this to you, which this is text from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service that are working with states to further clarify the rules and the conditions under which expansion above 138%, for example, or requirements of the Affordable Care Act.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon.
And we also have a copy of the actual language, which we can provide for you in law.
So would it take an actual vote of Congress?
Yes. Excuse me.
To change that 90%? Is that your understanding?
Senator Sharon.
Yes.
And so... Mr. Chair, to the amendment, Senator Sharon, I hope you would find this friendly. It seems to me I was sitting here actually thinking this would be an amendment that I wish I had, and all of a sudden it showed up. So Senator Fischbach, being an adjacent senator to mine, must think a lot alike, but because we haven't talked about this.
Senator Westrum, I don't know if that speaks well of yourself, but no. Go ahead.
Ooh, Mr. Chair.
Well, anyways, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm wondering if this language, and if it's not exactly this language that is comforting to you, I'm wondering if there's some language we could put in, because it does seem like it would be a good way to go and at least affirmatively say we're going to hold the federal government to this promise. If they're going to promise us this kind of money and we're going to make these changes, we're going to make them relying on what they're telling us they're going to do, and if that changes, then what we're doing doesn't continue. I would hope you'd find this amendment friendly, or a version of it, something practical that we should do as a state.
And members, we're having distributed a page of the federal language, which might be of some help. Senator Laurie, on the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think that... a couple of points to keep in mind here regarding this amendment. First off, we did hear, I believe, this very same amendment in the Health and Human Services Division. It certainly looks like it. And we had a long discussion of it there and determined it was not good policy. We have a long history with the feds in a shared state-federal program known as Medicaid. And there's never been any... action on the feds that has really changed that dynamic, especially like quickly. And it's clear that we can change our state's response in regards to what the feds do. I think that anticipating potential federal action is a very dangerous precedent here. For one thing, the way this is crafted, it would take us back to the standards that existed on December 31st of 2013. That would be 75% federal poverty level eligible for Medicaid at 0% federal participation. You know, I mean, so we're talking about a scenario where you know, there's this hypothetical situation where maybe the feds drop to 89% federal for everyone up to 138% of federal poverty level, which is still very manageable from the state level, to an automatic blink off when we may not be in session that puts everybody up to 75% of federal poverty level on Medicaid with zero federal financial participation at a much, much greater cost to the state. I think that's unwise to try to anticipate hypothetical situations at the federal level and craft potential responses without the legislature here. We have the ability to adjust our state Medicaid program to what the feds do. They have been clear in the law, and I actually did read this section of the law, and it is pretty clear that it's 100% for 3 years. While I can't cite it, I know that it becomes stable at 90% federal funding, and based on our longstanding history all the way back to the 60s of the feds putting up the financial participation that they've put on the books, you know, I think that this type of speculation is unwise and dangerous and could really put the state on the hook for a much lower level of service for hardworking, low-income Minnesotans, so a much lower level of service at a much higher state expenditure. I think that this would be really unwise, and that is the determination that we came to in the Health and Human Services Finance Division just last week. So I would really encourage members to vote against this amendment again.
For the discussion on the amendment, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, this does not automatically happen. There's a 60-day period where the legislature would be able to act if they're in session or a special session, whatever the case may be. It's not like it automatically happens. The legislature is notified and are allowed to act on it and decide if we want to spend those state dollars and how we want to do it. So it gives the legislature the opportunity after that 90% or it falls below that 90% to decide what we want to do for the state of Minnesota and how much money we want to spend. Do we want to make up that money? So this does provide the state of Minnesota and the legislature the decision to make and how we want to spend our money after if there is an issue of it falling below 90%. If you're that confident that by 2020 the federal government will still be at 90%, you know, then I guess you don't watch the news because there's a lot going on at the federal level, and I think that just this little bit of backup for us and to decide what the state of Minnesota wants to do with its money if the feds don't fulfill their promise or their obligation. I think that the amendment makes sense, and if it provides some, if it does provide us with some ability to change that when we need to, then I think that we should adopt this.
I think people understand the amendment, Senator Sharon.
I was going to say that during the Supreme Court discussions on the Medicaid expansion, there were clear language there that I can read to you that discussing the power of the federal government in relationship to this program as well as others where they've changed participation rates that although the Congress has the power to legislate under the spending power and that it has broad power, it does not include surprising participating states with post-acceptance or retroactive conditions in a surprising way. So I do think that this has been an important discussion. It's happened at every committee, whether or not, and it's just a bottom line of whether or not you think it's necessary or not. I'm encouraging a no vote on this because the language clearly allows for states to do whatever they need to do depending on information as it's presented to the state, and it's clear that the federal government cannot do something in a surprising way to participating states.
Further discussion on the A-12 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-12 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
A motion fails. Further discussion on Senate File 5. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who mentioned going to page 6 of the fiscal note. But there as well, Mr. Chair and members, was a question that I have of local governments. I go back to Senator Peterson's question of clarity here as to how much it's going to cost the counties. And each and every one of us represent counties here, and I guess I want to be armed just like everybody else. Pardon the pun. I guess there's not a good pun around here right now.
It's a different committee.
I want to be ready to be able to answer the county commissioners when they come to me and say, what kind of savings am I going to have with this particular bill? What impact is that going to have on local units of government? And if it's a cost savings, then I'm willing to say that if it's put on record or if it shows me that we're going to save some dollars for the counties. But if it's going to cost them those dollars, call it an investment maybe. I don't know what you would call it. We just need to know. I'm in two different places in here in the fiscal note. It isn't very clear. So I would expect everybody at the table would want to know that.
Senator Peterson, did you on that point? Did you?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I did get a hard copy of my fiscal note policy manual. I had not served on this committee before, so I printed this out and read it. It was updated December of 2012, two months ago, and under F, special circumstances. In fiscal note preparation, item 10, bills relating to technology impact, it clearly says MMB will assign the fiscal note to the impacted agency as a lead and, the word and, the Office of Enterprise Technology for response. Now, if they had gotten this fiscal note, I think it would say under Human Services Department, it would also say Office of Enterprise and Technology, would it not?
It might, but Mr. Nauman, you've worked on the promulgation of.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, if it were assigned to the Office of Enterprise Technology, and there's some nomenclature, Office of the Enterprise Technology, it would say at the top of the fiscal note that it was assigned there. It would also be a consolidated fiscal note. It's my understanding from discussions with MMB that they feel that they appropriately covered the fiscal impact by directing the fiscal note solely to the Department of Human Services. And as I mentioned, there is some ambiguity in terms of how the agency is working through processing the fiscal notes with respect to questions of this nature.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but does this relate to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, or should we answer that one?
Well, first? I mean, I'm inclined to support this bill, but my intent is to move to lay it on the table because I would like to talk to my county commissioners as well and get a better understanding of the cost to our county staff and administration. And then I would like to see a fiscal note from the Office of Enterprise Technology as well. So,
well, let's see if we have an answer to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question from people in the room and then get back to your concerns. Senator Schoener, Mr. Albrecht, relative to Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Cohen, Dennis Albrecht would like to speak to this issue, if
Mr.
he may.
Albrecht.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Peterson, what this bill does is change eligibility for the medical assistance program. Currently, counties do eligibility determinations through the MMIS system for the medical assistance program. These notes in this fiscal note are anticipating the interaction between the healthcare insurance exchange, or whatever it's called, if it happens to become law, and the eligibility determinations for medical assistance, which will be done through that system if it is becomes live. But these notes are not suggesting that there is an effect on some new technology or some new system as a result of this bill. This bill is just adding to what counties already do, in the sense that there may be a few more people that show up to apply for medical assistance once this bill is enacted.
And the other thing, Senator Ingebrigtsen, obviously, as a matter of course, we get the fiscal notes relative to our legislation and a state impact. There is available a local impact note, but it has to be through the request of a member. And so I don't know if you or anybody else has made that kind of a request relative to this, but there'd be a more exact answer if somebody had made a local impact note request. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Harbor. I think you probably hit the nail on the head here when with a few people. But Senator Sharon, you said there was going to be a considerable amount more people affected in Minnesota with this and by this bill. There's going to be an additional amount of, I don't know how many thousands you said. So that's not a real minimal impact on county governments, it would seem to me. I mean, if it was a 100 or 200 maybe, but I'm just trying to get my hand around if a county commissioner calls me.
I don't know if there's anybody present in the committee room who would have the ability to testify to that in terms of a local impact, a county impact, but apparently not. So I'm not sure we get a more exact answer than where we are. Senator Peterson, did you want to get...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd move to lay the bill on the table until we have...
That's a non-debatable motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion fails. Further discussion on Senate File 5. Senator Westrum.
Chair, one second part to the question I had earlier. Senator Sharon, the relationship to Minnesota Care and this sounds like we move about 50,000, 53,000 people currently enrolled in Minnesota Care into the early MA or the MA program. We're then authorizing a transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund to pay that. Is that an exact dollar-for-dollar expense, cost a little more, cost a little less, so it's a savings for the department or for the Healthcare Access Fund? First part of the question is that. Is there a savings? Second part of the question is long-term, and I had this question asked to me this weekend back at a meeting in my district, and it sort of relates to this, and it maybe is premature, and if you don't know the full answer, that's fine. But the question they asked me was, with the Healthcare Access or healthcare exchange, excuse me, healthcare exchange bill that's coming through, does Minnesota Care go away? And I said, I don't think so. But does it go away? And then if that goes away, does it relate or affect this bill at all, if that's the case, if you know the second part of the answer as well? But the first part being, what is the savings or the cost, or is it neutral to the Healthcare Access Fund?
Sarah Sharon.
There is cost savings to the Healthcare Access Fund as a result of this bill. And some of those savings are transferred to the general fund to help cover other costs associated with the expansion. Minnesota Care does not go away as a result of this bill, but as a result of the Affordable Care Act, we will be and continue to have discussions about the future of Minnesota Care and about how it will be designed and how we will treat those who are 138% to 200% of poverty. And what we are in conversations about with the federal government is what the rules will be for how we can treat that population and whether or not we'll be able to use, for example, the premium privileges under the exchange for helping fund something that looks like the Minnesota Care program as that design moves forward.
So, okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the Minnesota Care program could go away and be merged into the health exchange program, or it could just continue as it is in a different version. Is that right? And then one last question after that.
That is essentially correct. That we will, there is this conversation called the basic health care plan that we will decide. It may look like our current Minnesota Care program. It may be the current Minnesota Care program for a while. It may be a modification of that because it needs to be adjusted according to the requirements of the Affordable Care Act about caps on hospitalization, for example. Those kinds of rules are yet to in conversation. That's why the commissioner and the governor have been going to Washington to try to get a handle on what the rules will be for managing this population. So that still is unclear. It is not. There's nothing about this bill that relates to that, but it is a future discussion about the future of Minnesota Care, what it will look like. Will it be changed? Will it be morphed into a new program? And that's unclear.
For this bill specifically, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, 138%, can you just share with the committee and for our information before we vote, what does that equate to for a single person, a family of whatever, two or four or six people? What are those kind of incomes?
For a household of one, 133% of poverty is $14,856.
Okay.
And then it increases up to a family of four, $30,657. That's 133% of poverty. And for each additional person, you add $5,267.
I see. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just had a question. I'm not sure if it's for Mr. Boddard, but I'm a little unclear as a committee member, you know, what to do or what recourse I would have, you know, when we have a committee chair that isn't willing to follow the policy manual for fiscal notes.
Well, Senator Peterson, that's why I asked Mr. Nauman to reflect on what had happened. If you have a question for Mr. Boddard.
That was my question, okay, sure. Yeah. What recourse does a committee member have when we have a chair that doesn't follow the policy?
Mr. Boddard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, one thing I would point out is I think what you're looking at is an executive branch document.
Yep.
So what Senator Cohen does with that is affected by the interplay between the legislative and executive branches. And that's, I think, his prerogative in interpreting whether or not they've met their requirements, their self-imposed requirements. I don't think I have a whole lot to offer you other than how you ultimately decide to vote on the bill. You've attempted to table the bill, and you've made your concerns known.
Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 5. Does anybody wish to move the bill or any other motions?
Move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas only moves that Senate File as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Oh.
Motion carries. Members, that's the only matter we have on the agenda, so committee is adjourned.
Thank you.